The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show. Fortunately or unfortunately, Mr. Metaxas, because today is the big launch day of his brand new spiritual memoir called Fish Out of Water, I have to host the show today. So I'm sorry about that. To some of you, maybe it's good news. To some others, maybe not so much. But I have a very, very special and exciting guest to share with you today. And his name is none other than Mr. Eric Metaxas, sir.
Yeah, how you doing? How are you?
Hi. Okay. I'm
going to give you a taste of what it is to have a gruff guest.
Okay. Yeah, and you have that. You deal with those all the time. I mean,
it's murder. Being a radio host, I got to tell you, Alvin, it's murder. And I want to give you a taste of that murder right now. Go ahead.
Okay. I felt like I already was murdered and we were just on the air 30 seconds. Hey, I want to start this interview off right, because this is a big day. It's like the birth of a new book, Fish Out of Water. I want to celebrate correctly. And Chris Himes is here with me, but we're going to sing Happy Pub Date to you. How do you like that? Happy Publication Day to you. Happy Publication Day to you. Happy Publication Day, dear Eric. Happy Publication Day to you.
It's a fish out of water.
Hey,
I'm blushing. I'm blushing so badly that I'm afraid to show my face. I feel like Elmer Fudd. Guys are so sweet. Listen, in all seriousness, we're joking around like we're being like buffoons here. I am so grateful to you, Alvin and Chris, for wanting to do this. It was not my idea. And I have to say that I really am going to try to be a good guest, not like those other guests like Zmirak and all those people that you can't get a word out of them. I'm going to talk. And okay. I'm also going to say, before we forget, tonight, This is nuts. Salem Radio has set up a thing tonight, live at 8 p.m. Eastern. It's going to be live on our YouTube channel and live on my Facebook page. And I'm sending those links out. But it's a special launch event. 20 people from around the country have paid money to come on and ask me hard-hitting questions. This is the launch event. And I want everyone, please join us tonight. It's going to be nuts. I promise you, it's going to be insane. It's 8 p.m. Eastern tonight. Just had to say that. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, back to me. And if you're listening on radio, you do not know that we have a cupcake with a lit candle. And Eric, I would like you to blow it out right now, if you could, please. One,
this is not going to be easy because my internet connection is weak, but I'm going to try.
Try. I had that's okay. It's good. It's out. It's out.
We did it.
Got a little smoke in the room.
Because I don't have 5G. Okay.
Also, if you're watching from home, you can actually see I'm dressed up. Now on the radio, can't see this, but I'm actually wearing my Calvin Klein jacket, my Charles Tirrett shirt, my Ralph Lauren tie that says it's handmade in Italy, and if I were wearing pants, they'd be Hugo Boss. There you go.
And Chris Himes is wearing a union suit.
It's true. We have about 3 feet of snow here or something, so it seems appropriate.
Yeah, that's true. We do have about 2.5 feet outside my window. You saw some of it yesterday.
Oh, okay. Alvin, listen, before I forget, I don't want to correct you out of the gate, but the book Fish Out of Water is not really a spiritual memoir. When you get to the end, it is, but it's basically a literary memoir. Like, it's written from the point of view of somebody, me, right, who's kind of hostile to born again faith and evangelicals and stuff. So I grow up trying to sort it out. And I'm definitely not on that page. I'm sort of trying to avoid those people. I mean, this is my true story, right? And obviously I've said some of it is funny, but some of it is kind of painful and serious. We won't talk about that. But anyway, okay, you're going to interview me.
Yes.
So we're done with the preamble.
Okay.
So go ahead.
One last thing. There are a lot of people out there saying, like, okay, it's Eric's fish out of water day, but what about Groundhog Day? Did the groundhog see or not see his shadow? You know what? I'm sure he didn't see his shadow because there's like still 6 feet of snow out there, but Eric's fish out of water. Now that the fish is out of water, we've got six more decades of great reading ahead of us because this book is going to be a classic for Eric.
That's very nice.
Thank you very much.
You're so nice.
Okay. Okay. Now, let me start by saying this. It's just a general overview of the book. I got a sense when I was reading it, it almost read like one of your biographies and not a sort of autobiography, because there's a bit of the Bonhoeffer, Martin Luther, William Wilberforce in there, where you go in the past and say, well, what made these people who they are? And in this book, you talk about your dad, your mom, but also your grandparents and even great-grandparents and how they contributed to who you are, right? So my question is to you, the first thing I want to ask is, how did your parents, they must have read the book, how did they receive this book and the tales of all their relatives that they read about? Can you give us a little hint on any of that?
Well, first of all, the number one person I want to thank for making everything possible is Mike Lindell, the sponsor of this program. Make sure you use the code Eric. I just wanted to cheapen things by beginning that way, Albin. And of course, I got all dressed up because I take this very seriously. You're interviewing me, okay? So your first question, of course, it's a doozy. Let me think about this. I think, well, my mom, I gave her an early copy of the book to read. And it's the whole thing is so bizarre because she's a figure in the book. I mean, I tell her childhood story and all these different things. And I thought, what kind of a weird thing it would be to read a book and you're in the book and you remember the stuff better than the guy writing the book. And it's just crazy. So her response was she kept saying over and over how funny it was. And I said, can you be specific? No. I think when you hit your mid-80s, that's asking too much. And I kept saying, Mom, like, I'm a writer. I need encouragement. Tell me what you thought was funny. I don't know. Just, you know, the whole thing. So the early part of the book, a lot of it is funny because it's crazy stories of growing up. And so, but the fact that she raved about how funny it was, I thought, that's like, I'm thrilled. And then my aunt, my Tante Eleanor, who's another figure in the book, she said the same thing. Like she said, oh, it's really funny. It's really funny. It's really funny. And I thought, could you be specific? Unfortunately, she's also in her mid-80s. She refused to be specific. But the fact that they found it funny, I was thrilled. Now, my dad, he's 93 and a half. His eyesight is now at a point where he can't read. So I have the audio book is coming out. And of course, I have shared tons of it with him. I mean, I was on the phone with him, you know, for the last 2 years asking him questions about my childhood and stuff. And in a weird way, I think I said this, he ends up being the hero of the book.
Yes.
I don't know why. It's not like I planned that, but my love for him comes through on most pages. And it's not like I intended that. I just told the story. And then the publicist, the Balabans, insisted that I put this picture of my dad on the cover. And I thought, really? And they said, yes, because it's the immigrant experience. And statue. So the picture on the cover, I know I've said this before, but it's my dad on a date with my mom. It's 1958. She took the picture. So it's the whole thing. It's kind of cool. But their response, you know, my parents, they never give you what you're looking for.
Well, yeah, that's, I think everybody's parents are like that because of the generational thing and because they know you so well. Sometimes they think, well, you know what I'm talking about. We grew up together. But that leads me to another question. My second question here is the chapter called Because He's Your Father. Now, when you read the chapter head, an older person like myself, right away, I know what you're talking about. And it's a great, it's a wonderful sentiment. But it's also sad in a way because I think some people I may think, Like, what does he mean by that? Because he's my father? What does that mean? Now, I know we're going to a break, but maybe when you come back, maybe you can talk about what you specifically mean about that and talk about a couple things that give an example about the father-son and the father-daughter, the father-child relationship, and how important that was in your life and in the book.
I'm not keeping my eye on the clock since you're the host today, but I just will say that that was my Uncle Joe telling me that, and I'll get to that when we come back. But it's one of the most moving things I've experienced in my life. I love my Uncle Joe. He was like a dad to me. I loved him like crazy, and he's gone, and I miss him terribly. But when we come back, I'll explain the story.
Okay, folks, we'll be right back with Eric Metaxas and Fish Out of Water. Hey, Eric, it's Eric Metaxas. He's the guest on his own show today. This is Albin Sadar. I'm kind of hosting here along with Chris Himes, who's also here in the background. And I wanted to pick up on the question we had right before the break. I was asking you about father's relationship because you have a chapter called Because He's Your Father. And I wanted you to elaborate on that father, that chapter title, yeah. And your dad.
Well, it's kind of funny. I was maybe 13 years old. This is the chapter in the book. I was about 13 and I was out in the country, what we call the country, which is Suffolk County with my Uncle Joe. And, you know, we always would go out there, and I must have like said something disparaging about my dad, something disrespectful. And my dad and mom left. They had to run an errand, and my Uncle Joe took me and my brother, who's a year and a half younger than I am, Johnny. He took us aside and he gave us like a speech, and I will never, ever forget it. It was like a sermon. Now, my Uncle Joe was not a religious man, but it was like a sermon. He heard me be disrespectful of my father, and he did not shout. He did not humiliate us. He did not. It was really an amazing balance of being able to speak with this authority, because we looked up to my Uncle Joe like crazy. And the refrain, like a preacher, he kept saying, because he's your father. And what I find amazing is I didn't understand the theology behind it. I just knew that what my uncle was saying was correct. Like inside, something inside me witnessed to the fact that it doesn't matter what your father says or does. He is your father and you need to respect him. And it's only in years later that I understood that we say that about the president, right? We say about the office of the presidency. We haven't said it so much because people have been really vicious toward Trump, but I said it when Obama was president. I thought his policies were evil, but the office of the presidency deserves respect. And it's a biblical concept, yes, that the office of mother, father, grandparent, they deserve respect simply because of God's image. The fatherhood of God is represented by your father. And I knew this even as I was 13 when my uncle said this. He didn't understand the theology behind it, but he just knew that to disrespect your father was wrong, that you needed to respect him because he's your father. I mean, it just hit me as a kid. Like I just felt guilty because I knew, you know, you think at that point, wow, what my father has done for me, and I would dare to be disrespectful. This guy, yeah, has given his whole life. He's worked, you know, his fingers to the bone, worked odd jobs, worked second jobs, worked overtime. He's done all this stuff.
Yeah.
And when my daughter was born 21 years ago, I will never forget having that feeling. Like if my parents felt the tiniest bit of what I'm feeling for this daughter, I owe them everything. Like I suddenly had a sense of, oh my goodness, the love and the responsibility that I feel toward this child was so overwhelming. I thought I have not thanked my parents enough. I have not treated them with enough love. Yeah. Because I never understood it before. But when I was 13, when my uncle gave me that speech, it hit me in a way. And I have given the same speech effectively to young men and said to them, doesn't matter what how your father screwed up. It doesn't matter. He's your father. Yeah. And you owe it to him and to God and to yourself to treat him with respect. He doesn't have to earn that respect. He's your father.
Yeah.
And it's a wild, but it just hit me so much how I had disrespected my dad. And, you know, I spent the rest of my life trying to make up for it. I don't know if I ever could, but I love him so much. And his love for me, I could see it as an undergirding presence in my life, which to me is a picture of the fatherhood of God, is that it's there even when you don't acknowledge it. It's there supporting you. You take it for granted. So
I know, you know, and a lot of this resonated with me, and I'm hoping, of course, it will resonate with a lot of the readers. But, you know, my own father, he worked two jobs and he was constantly doing something. And then on the weekends, he'd be mowing the grass or he'd be, you know, fixing the car. He was constantly doing something. And he never once, and there were five of us kids, he never once said, "I worked my fingers to the bone for you kids. And this is the way," you know, he just did his duty, as it were. And he loved us. He still had time to play baseball with us and all these things, even though he had two jobs and took a nap in between the two of them. It's an amazing feat. So the way this honors both your parents, but especially your dad, is just, it brings tears to your eyes. It really does.
Yeah. And as I said, it's not like I intended that, but just telling the story, it is, and it's so funny because I'm asking my dad these questions as I'm writing the book. It's like, what happened then? And what would tell me this story and tell me that? And there's a couple of stories in the book. They're my favorite stories because they're very funny. And they're things that my father said or did, which I find unbelievably hilarious. There's the V8 story and there's the leprechaun story is my favorite.
Yes.
And the whooper story.
Yes.
The whooper story. Don't give that away, but
I won't.
But those three stories kill me. They're just like, there's other stuff, but the leprechaun and the whooper story and the V8 story. And so I'm telling my father, you know, this stuff. And he's like, "Well, I don't want, you know, my friends to read that I did this or whatever." Yeah. And I said, "Dad, I don't think you're getting it. You end up being the hero of the story. You're going to be like famous because again, it's not like I intended it, but when you do this weird thing and you tell your life story, you see things you did not see. And there's a lot of stuff in this book that I didn't see until I wrote the book.
Well, see, your dad is probably about maybe 7-8 more years older than what my father was. My father passed away, unfortunately, when he was only 78. But he was like that, too. He would mispronounce things. He'd say the wrong phrase. He would be funny like that without intending to be funny. And you bring all that out, of course, in the character of your father, who's a real character. That was the other question I had. I mean, I have a bunch of them. But one of them is, how did you remember such minutiae? I mean, you remembered names. You remembered locations and dates and times. And all this
like what? I mean, because I don't like.
The different characters. Like, I wanted to read something from the book. One of the funny sentences. I mean, you've got so many funny sentences and paragraphs. But one that I marked out here in particular was about the two people that you painted with. It was a husband and wife team, Alex and Anna. And the way you describe them and some of the work.
Listen, nobody can believe like that. There's not a syllable of exaggeration in that chapter. My father, it was kind of like the funny thing is like, I didn't get like a good job for the summer. Right. So my father said, "Okay, I'm going to call up Jerry," which is our friend, Jerry Fimiatos. And he calls him up and I'm going to work for Jerry painting houses, which was not going to be so great. Wasn't going to pay great, but I couldn't get anything. So I worked with Jerry and he had a couple who worked for him as painters. And it was bizarre doesn't do it justice. When people read that chapter, because there's no way to do it justice, but it was a couple, the guy ended up being a dedicated Nazi. Like it was the most insane thing. He was Hungarian. He loved Hitler. And I remember thinking, is this a joke? Like, I go to Yale, like I know the Nazis are evil. And you're telling me, you like this guy, like how do I have conversations with this person? There's no way to make it up.
Can I just read just a few sentences from that chapter? Okay, just to entice people. But this stuff is very funny. This is a description of Alex's wife, Anna. Okay, she was 10 years his senior and had the look of a pear-shaped 12th century peasant from the Russian steppe, with a face wrinkled beyond her years and horned hands with which, had tools been unavailable, she might have dug a moat. Often she struck me as prehistoric, bearing no small resemblance to a triceratops.
Okay, now listen, Pete, this actually listening to this, it sounds mean. If you got to read the chapter because you'll never believe it. This was the two of them. I ended up, this is what's so crazy. And this happens a couple times in the book. I ended up having an affection for these broken people, and they were very broken. She was like, there's no way to describe her. You just can't believe she was more vulgar than any of the workmen on the site. And so it was bizarre, but the two of them are like something like if you made them up in a novel, people say these are the most ridiculous characters ever. Right. But this is completely true. And there are other characters that summer that I encountered. It really was. I mean, you talk about a fish out of water experience. That was the ultimate fish out of water experience. I mean, the kid from Yale working with people that are like total like foul mouthed racists, and you know, it was insane. I don't know. Yeah, that's kind of the halfway point of the book. Are we out of time?
We still have about 20 seconds, but when we come back, I want to talk about a person I think is probably your favorite character in the book. I know that you probably have a few of them, but this Vlastos character. The Vlastos.
I could cry when I think of him.
I know.
Vlastos. He's one of the sweetest men.
He is.
Another character. He's the one that. Well, we'll talk about it when we get back.
Yeah, yeah. And I'll set it up, and you'll knock it out of the park. Okay. We're gonna be right back with our special guest Eric Metaxas after this. Hey, folks, we are back to the Eric Metaxas Show with our special guest, Eric Metaxas. I'm Elbin Sadar, one of the two producers. In the background, of course, is Chris Himes, the other producer. There he is. Chris, say hello.
Hello. Yeah, I actually heard.
Okay, that's enough.
Yeah, my wife, I have not been reading the book because I live the book. It's a pop-up book. No, I didn't live the book, but my wife's been reading it and she's enjoying it very much.
There you go. I've been reading it and laughing it. And Anne, my wife, she's usually upstairs in the bedroom trying to sleep or something. She's like, what's going on down there? But I wanted to pick up on something we ended the last segment with. This is a character, and a real life character, by the way, named Vlastos. And he had a strange living quarters in Manhattan. I think it was near the Village or something like that. And you stayed with him for a while because you had one of your first jobs with a publishing house, right? You were sending.
I was going to Yale, yeah. And I thought, okay, I want to be a writer. I better get a job like in publishing or something for the summer so I get some experience. And so I got this non-paying internship. Yes. It paid nothing. So when I told my parents about this, they like flipped. Like, what do you mean? How's that a job? It's paying you nothing. And then I thought, oh, well, I just got to find a free place to live and another job so I can make some money. So I got another job as a busboy. So I was working two jobs, and a friend of my godmother, my Nuna, F.E. Dragaris, who just passed away. She's another major figure in the book. I loved her so much, and I'm so sorry that I can't share this with her. But my Nuna, F.E. Dragaris, she said, oh, I have a friend, Andres Vlastos, and he lives in the city. Maybe you can stay with him for the 2 months while you're working these two jobs. So I went to this guy, and I had some idea in my head. My Nuna says that, Vlastos is Bohemian type. And, you know, in her accent, he's Bohemian type. And I said, Bohemian, that's perfect. Like, he's probably some artsy guy. Maybe he lives in the Village. And, you know, I had all these ideas, whatever. And I get off the bus at the Port Authority with my avocado colored suitcase, which didn't have wheels. And I walk and walk and walk and walk to 24th Street between, I think it's 6th and 7th Avenues, which is the definition of no man's land. Like, there's nothing there. There's like warehouses and loading docks and whatever. Yeah. And this guy had a loft of some kind. You know, people always talk about we have a converted loft. This was a totally unconverted loft.
Right.
It was like there was, it was like a machine shop. There was like a drill press. Like it was the most disgusting, weird place imaginable. And this strange, eccentric Greek man greets me and he called me boy. I think he forgot my name and never wanted to bother to ask me again. So he says, "Hey, boy." And he was like a wealthy miser. He had founded a publishing, Greek publishing thing. And he had a, there was a newspaper. And my father and mother, I remember telling them about this or whatever. And my mother says, "Vasta," oh, she says that when we were married, when we were dating or when we first got married, we would go to the beach with Effie and Nick, her husband, Nick Vigars, would get, and Vlastos would come along. And this is like, you know, 25 years earlier or more. And my mother says that this guy was eccentric then. He would wear a wool turtleneck to the beach and he was a strange bird. Let me tell you, my mother was like, "Yeah, I can't believe it." Yeah. So he, now I see this guy and he obviously had some money and he lived like the ultimate miser. There's no way to describe it. I mean, you got to read that chapter. But in the course of the summer, like he just broke my heart with how sweet he was to me. He was such a dear soul. Well, and there's some magical stuff in there. But can I tell the McDonald's story?
You want to tell the McDonald's story? Okay, because I was going to talk about how he had one of his inventions, because he was an inventor, and that's how he made some of his money. That's what's crazy.
He was inventor, yes.
But back then, of course, Mr. Coffee was big. Nowadays, we have the Keurig and all the little things, but right. Mr. Coffee was big, and he seemed to have used that same technology for his shower, where the water was instantly heated to boiling point or something to heat the shower, but it was like, he created this little thing that you got in the shower and there's a little trickle that came down on your head. And that's how you got a shower.
Think about it. We're talking about a loft with no hot water.
Right.
So he created some kind of a gizmo to heat the water. And it worked, but it only worked technically. And so in order to take a shower, the water would trickle. Like it was like if you had an eyedropper of hot water. It was the most unpleasant, bizarre. But what could I say? This was free. Like I'm not going to complain.
Right.
But I tell the story. I don't want to go into the details. But like the shower scene is
it's scarier than Psycho. Yeah. But tell the McDonald's story.
Well, actually, my favorite part is he said. Oftentimes, he would show me something, and then he would say, "It's my invention." Like he's telling me, "Yes, I invented this." And so he would say that about a few things he showed me. He had these inventions, and one was called Breezy Shoes.
Right.
And these were shoes. This invention never caught on. So he showed me like a yellowed clipping of when he tried to kind of make this work. And then he showed me the prototype of the shoe. And it was like an orthopedic looking hideous shoe with the thick rubber sole with square holes all along the sole, and then you looked inside and it was like a mesh. Your foot rested on like mesh so that you were walking on air. Okay. And he said, "I call them breezy shoes." And I said, "What? Breezy shoes? They're breezy because the breeze." And I won't say any more about it, but it was, there are things like that, these little magical things. For years, I've said, I have to write about this. No one will believe this. I've just got to write it down to the best of my ability. When we come back, I'm going to tell the McDonald's story because that's my favorite. I love this man. He's so sweet, and I'm glad I could write about him.
Hey, folks, welcome back to another segment of the Eric Metaxas Show. I'm Alban Sadar, one of the producers. Chris Himes is with me. He's another of the producers. Wow, two producers for one great guy, Eric Metaxas. And you know what? He's the guest on today's show talking about Fish Out of Water, which is out today. Eric, hello.
This is weird, man. This is freaking me out.
Wow,
I'm the guest
weird
of my
stuff.
Own program. Okay, so here's the issue. I got to tell the McDonald's stories because this Please. Is, you don't make this stuff up. This is, okay. So Vlastos and I, like I was kind of, I was 20 years old. I was 19. I turned 20 that summer. When I turned 20, the day I turned 20, my parents never called me up. Nobody called. Like, it was just the weirdest, saddest birthday. Yeah. But in the morning, I mentioned to Mr. Vlastos that it was my birthday. And he said, oh, it's your birthday. He runs out. He pulls a tarp away from an organ, plugs it in. He plays me happy birthday and sings happy birthday to me. It was so moving that for the rest of my life, I'll be thinking about it. Every once in a while, I would go out to dinner with him. And it was always like to a little diner or something, very cheap, like really cheap. And a couple of times we go to the McDonald's on Bleecker Street, which was a little bit of a walk. He was on 20th. Yeah. And so Bleecker's like, I don't know, 10, 15 blocks. And before we went in to the McDonald's, he said to me in his Greek accent, he said, here, they are calling me Mr. 305. Okay. See, here, they are calling me Mr. 305. Here, they are calling me Mr. 305. I didn't know what he meant. So we go up. He goes to the, you know, the teenage girl at the cash register, and he looks up and he blurts out. He says, filet of fish, French fries, strawberry sec. And she rings it up and she says, that'll be 305, sir. Evidently, that's what he ordered every single time he went there. And the girls thought I was kind of cute and funny. And so they called him Mr. 305. So later in the summer, after I'd moved into another apartment, I got together with him for dinner and he stopped on the street. He said, ah, I must tell you something. Recently, I have been promoted. I said, what do you mean? And he says, now they are calling me Mr. 312. Evidently, the price had gone up. But, yeah.
That's very, a lot of funny stories like this. I wanted to
listen. I
read it, so I can. I could tell people they're in for a real treat. But I wanted to shift moods for a second here. You dedicate the book, of course, the first part you dedicate, you say, yeah, this book is for my father and mother. Makes total, complete sense, because your father, your mother come out as heroes, right, as it were. And you see how they helped your life become what it is. But then the second dedication is to, is a Charles Kahn. And this is what you say, who swan dove into the period at the end of the sentence God wrote for her and emerged in his presence in heaven. Very sweet. Do you want to explain that?
Yes. I never intended to dedicate the book to Charis, but when I was writing it, Suzanne, my wife, kept asking, who'd you write this for? And I said, honestly, I have no clue. Like, this is one of these books. It's such a strange melange of stories and characters and shows all the different parts of me, you know, like insane, stupid humor with very serious faith stuff. And, you know, it's like this big mixture. And I couldn't really say, like, so who did I write it for? I don't know. And then it hit me. I know exactly who I wrote it for. I wrote it for Charis, C-H-A-R-I-S. Charis Kahn, C-O-N-N is her last name. She was a friend, brilliant woman. She was a senior editor at Harper's Magazine. That's Lewis Lapham, you know, the literary magazine, for 20 years. And just brilliant, brilliant. And when I had my faith conversion thing, she continued to be my friend and would ask me questions about it. And I would tell her all these crazy stories about faith or miracles or this or that. And I was really trying to share my faith with her, but without being too forward about it. And she remained my friend and really appreciated me in a way that very few friends have ever appreciated me. She was incredibly sweet and funny and brilliant. And I just, you know, like just a true friend that you've had over the years. And we didn't really see each other much, but when we saw each other, it was like no time had passed. And the bizarre coda to the story is that of all the people I could think of who I would expect not to be interested in becoming, you know, a Jesus follower, I would say she was probably at the top of the list. But she had some illness and one day let me know, shocked me, that she prays, she believes in Jesus. And I really couldn't get my head around it. I thought, like, really? Like, I just don't believe it. but it was true. It was just the most amazing thing. And it had to do with my sharing these stories over the years. And I mean, many years. And she died very young. She was in her mid-50s of a very rare blood disease, one of the most amazingly strange things ever. But she died as somebody who believed in the God of the Bible. And at her memorial service, I talked to all her friends who are, you know, kind of like Brooklyn literary liberal agnostics, I guess. And I kind of shared this with them. And I think some of them got it and some of them didn't. But I just thought, in a way, I wrote this book for folks like them, for people who are totally not on the same page as we might be politically and theologically, but just as a literary read. And in a way, that was my approach to Charis all those years. I wasn't trying to convert her. I wasn't talking to her, you know, necessarily very overtly about the Bible. I was just sharing stuff. And somehow God used that and led her to himself. And her picture is in the book toward the end. And anyway, that's all I'll say about it. It was just, but her friendship, she was a very, very amazing person. And so her death was very upsetting. But the fact that somehow, amazingly, this brilliant literary genius found her way to faith. And she said in a letter, because of my time with her over the years, you know, that meant everything to me. And I realized this book is for her and for her friends.
Yeah, that's very beautiful. And I know you lost a lot of friends. That comes out in the book. When you became a Christian, they treated you like a leper. And that's also in the Bible, but they probably didn't believe in the healing of
them. Well, I mean, I think it's asking a lot of people. I mean, we can talk about that in the final segment.
Yeah. We got to go to a break. Sorry, got to cut you off there, Eric. We'll be right back with Eric Metaxas.
Somewhere beyond the sea, somewhere waiting for me, my lover stands on golden sand.
Hey, folks, we're back with Eric Metaxas. He's the guest on his very own program. Isn't that
something?
Get out of here. So we've been talking about Fish Out of Water, which premieres, if you will, today. Okay, today's opening day. So go out there, folks, and buy the book and enjoy it. Eric, I'm going to throw over to you. What do you have for the folks?
Actually, I should mention this. I just published an op-ed today, which... I put it on social media and I sent out to my email list. It's called The Secret Vocabulary of the Heart. And it talks about the ending of the book and the dream that I had. But that's out. I've posted that. And I would appreciate, because I've been shadow banned on Facebook and we've been having some social media issues, anything you can share on social media, I would be so grateful. If you can retweet the tweets or share what's on Facebook, or if you can find it someplace else and put it on your own Facebook page, because I've been having real problems. But Alvin, I've got to say this tonight on Facebook Live and on YouTube. And again, I'm sending these links out. We're sending emails. If you're not on the list, what can I tell you? But tonight is the official launch event. 20 people from around the country have paid money to ask me questions, like hard-hitting questions. So it's going to be loony, and I'm going to be hosting that, and I'm going to be answering these questions that the people have. And so that's tonight, 8 p.m. Eastern. It's the launch event. So if there's anybody who can join us there, the link will be, you know, I'm posting it on all my social media and we sent out an email today. But I think if you just go to our YouTube page for the show, the Eric Metaxas Show YouTube page, it should be there or on my Facebook.
Yeah, if you're a subscriber to the YouTube channel, you'll get a notification when it's about to go live. And if you miss it for some reason, don't worry. We'll post the video after it's over. But obviously, thanks. It's more fun live if you can make it.
And I have to say, because this is how we pay the rent, but if anybody's ever interested in buying a book, you want to buy it as soon as possible. That helps sell the book. It has gotten really wonderful reviews. I'm on the Dinesh D'Souza program today. He loved it, which thrilled me because you never know what people are going to think. But I've been getting a lot of let me just be honest, surprisingly positive feedback, because when I wrote the book, I kind of didn't know what I had. You know, you do your best, you put it out there, but you just don't know, because you're so close to it. If you're writing about your own experiences, you really have no idea if it's going to resonate with other people. So far, it seems to have, but I do want to ask people to please do what you can.
I think you fooled a lot of people by writing like mundane stories with beautiful words. I don't know how you did it.
That's my plan, to fool people.
Okay, I'm being sarcastic like you sometimes, Eric.
I'm never sarcastic.
No. I thought that was your love language. Isn't that your love language?
It is my love language. And you know, we forgot to say there's a lot of pictures in the book.
Yes, a lot of pictures.
Crazy stuff. Yeah. I hope some people are touched by it. And I do mean it when I say that if I wrote the book specifically for people maybe who are on the same page as we are theologically or politically, to share it with people who aren't. Yeah. Because I think there's very little out there for folks like that. People like my friend Cheris, who, they're not going to read a Christian book. I mean, it's not really a spiritual biography. It's a literary biography.
It is.
With a spiritual ending. Yes. And I think that if it were more overtly Christian throughout, a lot of people wouldn't read it who are not on that page. And I specifically wrote it for, I wrote this book for those people because I really wanted to reach them. I know we're out of time.
There's a very thin thread of the Christianity running throughout, and it doesn't shout
intentionally thin. Yeah. Not till the ending does it come really out.
We're going to be back with more with Eric Metaxas after a commercial break.